We have a way of looking straight down through the airplane, and you'll see maybe occasionally a little airliner, and it looks like a little toy.
NASA flies a high-altitude plane out of Fairbanks for sea ice science. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a problematic musk-ox encounter in Kotzebue.
I got a call about 6 a.m. saying there was a musk-ox in town in John Becker's dog lot.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
NASA is piloting a mission out of Fairbanks with a specialized plane that can fly high enough to test technology destined for satellite applications. KUAC's Dan Bross has more on the ER-2 mission.
What's it like to fly into the stratosphere aboard the NASA ER-2 jet? Pretty cool, according to test pilot Tim Williams.
We have a way of looking straight down through the airplane, and you'll see maybe occasionally a little airliner, and it looks like a little toy. You know, it's just this little bitty little plane down there. We are much higher than everything else out there.
So high that the sleek, long-winged, converted U-2 spy plane is used to test and develop satellite-deployed technology.
We have a high-altitude laser altimeter, a LIDAR, that we're using in anticipation of a satellite mission in 2017.
That's Assistant NASA Research Scientist Kelly Brunt. She's in charge of scientific work that'll be conducted at 65,000 feet over Arctic sea ice and Alaskan glaciers during the Fairbanks space missions. It's a follow-up to a 2012 winter LIDAR scan in Iceland.
Collecting similar data, laser altimetry data, over sea ice with ponds on it, summer sea ice, and we're going to assess how the laser operates maybe differently in those conditions as opposed to the cold sea ice that we have based out of Iceland.
Kelly says NASA knows the LIDAR scanning works, and the Fairbanks Space Project will be used to develop a computer program to interpret the data. It's all part of an assessment of the polar ice sheet's contribution to sea level change, but the trips between Fairbanks and the ice will be used to gather additional LIDAR data.
Collecting data sets for other science projects, people that are interested in inland water bodies, people that are interested in permafrost, vegetation.
It's not the first time the ER-2 is operated out of Fairbanks, a prime location because of its proximity to the Arctic. Pilot Tim Williams, who wears a space pressure suit while at the controls of the single-seat ER-2, likens the experience to space travel.
There's a point where you actually can see stars and you can see the sun. And the reason you can see the stars is because the sun is setting, and over the curvature of the Earth, it's throwing a shadow, which is nighttime over there, and you can see stars. It's amazing.
Williams says he likely won't get that view on the flights out of Fairbanks this summer because of the extended daylight hours. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics has issued a new report on the hazards of coal dust in Seward. The organization is recommending further monitoring, but as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, city officials deny that local air quality is poor.
During February of 2012 through April of 2013, citizen volunteers collected air samples in Seward, mostly from the Seward Boat Harbor area. The volunteers were trained by Alaska Community Action on Toxics and the Resurrection Bay Conservation Alliance, and by Global Community Monitor, an organization that conducts citizen monitoring efforts throughout the country. They wanted to find out how much of the particulate matter in Seward's air is coal dust. Russ Maddox with the Resurrection Bay Conservation Alliance says the dust problems in the city have been ongoing for about 8 years. At a press conference announcing the release of the report, Maddox said the citizen-collected evidence points to coal dust.
We finally have, for the first time, real-life data that I feel is irrefutable that at times, over half of the dust in Seward is coming from the coal facility and is coal dust.
The target of the tests is the Seward coal loading facility, which ACAT says is responsible for the coal dust in Seward's air. SCLF is owned and operated by Aurora Energy, a subsidiary of Usabelli Coal. The Alaska Railroad uses the facility in shipping coal out of Alaska. According to the report released Thursday, the coal dust in varying degrees does make up the majority of the particulate matter in Seward's air, although not in quantities deemed to be unlawful by federal standards set by the Environmental Protection Agency. Pam Miller is executive director of ACAT.
That coal really makes up the majority of dust that was captured in our air monitors. And from our report, we concluded that the coal loading facility is a major contributor to airborne pollution in Seward. And this does present a real health hazard to people living in Seward, particularly to children, the elderly, and those with chronic illnesses.
City officials in Seward were not made aware of the report. Assistant Seward City Manager Ron Long says he is not qualified to give a scientific assessment of Seward's air quality. Russ Maddox says the city has turned a deaf ear to residents' complaints about the dust since he began fighting for better air quality in 2006.
The city has been absolutely uncooperative since day one. And unfortunately, the city and the railroad in Aurora act as one entity here. And with Aurora denying that there's a coal dust problem, the city and the railroad have been parroting that same claim all along.
But in 2010, the city of Seward, in response to some residents' complaints about dust, asked the State Department of Environmental Conservation to conduct an air quality study. That study, conducted between January of 2011 and May of 2012, did not find particulate matter in excess of EPA standards in Seward's air. Maddox says that the conservation groups are not attempting to shut down the coal loading facility, but they do want the facility to institute containment measures to keep the coal dust down. He says consultants in the past have advised the coal loading facility to provide sprinklers on the coal stockpiles and enclosed conveyors so that the dust can be vacuumed up before loading. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Living with wildlife isn't always easy, as a recent incident with a muskox attack in Kotzebue makes clear. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
A bull muskox is dead after it was shot by an area biologist in Kotzebue following the goring of a sled dog early last Friday morning.
I got a call about 6 a.m. saying there was a muskox in town in John Baker's dog lot. And so I went down there and the muskox was there. And very close quarters.
Jim Dow has been with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kotzebue for 25 years and says the running six-year-old from last week's incident stood out.
We've had muskox, you know, around Kotzebue for a long time. It's usually just, you know, a single animal. Once in a while, it's a couple. But what made this one unusual was just the persistence of this bull. He just kept coming back.
Dow and others had already chased the animal out of town using four-wheelers, trucks, and a small plane Thursday night. But early Friday morning, after it injured a sled dog in Iditarod champion John Baker's lot, Dow and a local dog catcher found the animal hanging in a nearby construction site and felt they were running out of options.
Town was waking up, and we just didn't see any chance of getting him out of the city. So we killed him where he was. It was in a good spot, a safe spot. And that was the other thing. If he'd have moved, we wouldn't have had the option of shooting him because he would have been, you know, in front of a house.
Dow shot the bull through the neck with a .270 rifle, which killed it quickly.
As far as meat salvage goes, as soon as I killed him, I called Cyrus Harris from Manelik. He administers the traditional foods program. And I told Cyrus that I'd had to destroy this muskox, and was he interested in the meat for the food program? And boy, he was absolutely interested. Came right down. He was there in 15 minutes and helped me butcher it. And we hung the meat for a day. The meat will go to... He's got a whole list of elders around town that he provides with traditional foods.
Alaska regulations on killing an animal in defense of life or property, DLP as it's known, require turning hides, skulls, and game meat over to the Department of Fish and Game. Trophy pieces are warehoused until they're auctioned off in February, but local managers use their own discretion about salvageable meat. They're guided by the department's general principle that DLP incidents cannot benefit an individual, but should bring something back to the community.
The meat is often what is really most highly valued, especially by villagers. And so I've always, you know, asked people, I can't force them, but I said, look, can you find people who need the meat that can use it? And sometimes they say, oh, yeah, we've already salvaged the meat. It's hot. And, you know, it's spread all through, you know, Deering or Ambler or wherever. And people have been really good with us over the years about making sure that that meat doesn't go to waste.
Because local decision-making about wildlife varies in different parts of the state, there's no saying what the standard protocol is for salvaging wild meat. Peter Bente coordinates ADF&G management from Barrow all the way down to Bethel and says DLP cases in Nome, where his office is, are infrequent, popping up just every few years. In the past, the department has worked with a local senior center and an emergency shelter, donating DLP'd moose and a muskox hit on the road by a truck. Dow is well aware of the recent muskox troubles in Nome, as well as calls from residents to expand allowable takes. But he cautions that destroying the animals should never be approached lightly.
My situation was actually pretty easy. It was one bull that just kept coming back. We did everything we could to get him out. It was an easy decision. But boy, when you're faced with a bunch of a dozen muskox and there's cows and there's calves, what do? You can't just decide we're going to pull the trigger on 18 muskox.
The last I had heard, the dog injured in the early morning incident is expected to recover. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, international skiers train for the World Cup on the Eagle Glacier.
We don't have glaciers that we can ski on during summer, so it's really nice to be able to ski this late in the summer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com.
Juno charity organization St. Vincent de Paul has a record high number of people staying in its transitional housing shelter. Usually, around 55 people live in the 26 units. At the moment, there are 66 occupants. Almost half are children. KTOO's Lisa Fu visited the shelter yesterday and has this report.
12-year-old Carrie McVeigh has been living in and out of transitional housing at St. Vincent de Paul for as long as she can remember.
I've just been calling St. Vincent's home because I've been here most of the time.
Carrie lives with her 16-year-old sister, 11-year-old brother, and their parents.
We're all just living in one room.
Carrie's father works for Gold Belt Security Services, and her mother doesn't work. During the school year, Carrie goes to Juneau Community Charter School. She's open with her classmates about sometimes living in a shelter.
Because, like, some of my friends would ask if they could stay the night, and I'd have to tell them no.
Carrie says there are more kids at the shelter than usual, which means she actually has someone her age to hang out with. During the summer, Carrie visits the playground and wanders around the shelter.
I like going in and hanging out with some of the other families because, you know, I know how they feel. Most of us just feel alone, like we have nowhere to go.
Carrie wants her family's stay at the shelter to be what it's supposed to be, transitional.
I hope that, you know, we can get our own house, that, you know, we can stay for once. Because it seems like, you know, every year we move from one house and then back in here, and I'm getting tired of it.
Carrie is one of 30 kids currently living at the shelter. St. Vincent de Paul housing manager Tammy Martini says the high number of shelter occupants is driven by the number of kids. She says families at the shelter usually have one or two kids. At the moment, several families, like the McVeighs, have three children. A couple families have more.
It's sad to see a large family with children that are homeless for whatever reason. I mean, it's, you know, being homeless is sad for everybody, but those children deserve to be in a place of their own and not in a room. And they need more room to wander around and be kids and be outside poking at bugs or whatever, you know, just being kids.
Individuals and families can stay in transitional housing for a maximum of 2 years, though most families stay for a year. In order to get in, there's an application and an average wait time of 6 months. Rent is $525 a month. That gets a person or family a 400-square-foot room, which includes a bathroom with a toilet and sink, shared kitchen, laundry, and shower facilities, as well as a kid's playroom and a computer area for job searching. Martini says residents are required to be actively looking for permanent housing and for work if they don't have it.
We do keep on top of that and have frequent conversations with the families about what are you doing to move on to a better situation. So, like, even though it is probably the cheapest rent in town, especially for a family, it's not something that we want anybody to consider the last stop.
Corey McDonald and his wife live at the shelter with their three kids.
Miles is the oldest, he's 7. Leland is 5, and little Chloe is 4.
This is the family's second stint. They spent about 6 months in the shelter 2 years ago. This time, it's been about 3 months. In between, they've lived with family in town. They haven't lived as a whole family in their own place for 3 years. Both parents have jobs, but McDonald is away from the family for large chunks of time.
I've been in and out of trouble, so I'm actually out on an ankle monitor here right now.
For tight space, the McDonald's have made the room as homey as possible. The parents have a large bed in one corner. In another corner, Miles and Chloe share a homemade bunk bed with Leland's bed at the foot of it.
Then we got our fridge and our entertainment system, and we brought this freezer in here so we can store extra food and stuff, and this is our little dining area set up.
The children look at home, sitting on the beds, eating crackers and watching TV. But McDonald doesn't want this to be home, at least not forever. The plan is to stay at the shelter for up to a year while McDonald and his wife save up enough money to buy a home of their own. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The U.S. Senate voted yesterday to confirm two members of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. One of those nominations was approved over the outspoken objection of Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski. KTNA's Philip Manning followed the vote and has the story.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, had two members confirmed on Tuesday. Cheryl LaFleur, acting chair of the commission, was approved in a 90-7 vote. The vote for the second nominee, Norman Bay, had a much closer vote of 52-45. The vote on Bay's nomination fell along mostly partisan lines, though two Democrats did break ranks to vote with the Republican minority. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska was one of the more vocal opponents of Norman Bay's nomination. Murkowski, the ranking Republican on the Senate Energy Committee, says that part of her reason for opposing the nomination has to do with President Barack Obama's intent to make Bay, a first-time commission member, the chairman of FERC. It's the agency that, among other things, licenses hydroelectric projects, like the proposed Susitna Dam. That's far from all there is, however. Senator Murkowski explained in a floor speech on Tuesday what else FERC does.
In the energy world, FERC regulates midstream everything. The chairman is its CEO, and under his or her leadership, FERC regulates interstate natural gas and oil pipelines, LNG import and export facilities, the sale of electricity at wholesale.
Senator Murkowski also says that Norman Bay's tenure as the head of FERC's enforcement division has also raised questions. In the past, she said that she would not necessarily oppose Bay's nomination if it were not for President Obama's plan to promote him to chair. On Tuesday, however, she mentioned questions about Norman Bay's handling of enforcement for FERC. In the end, Bay's nomination was confirmed, albeit not by a large margin. While Senator Murkowski says she does not always agree with acting FERC Chair Cheryl LaFleur, she does support her nomination to continue on the commission. Robert Dillon, a spokesman for Senator Murkowski, refers to LaFleur as a liberal Democrat, but says that the senator has been impressed by her ability to lead. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Standdown event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA.
A strong earthquake near the Canadian border rattled portions of southern Alaska and the Yukon Territory just before 4 a.m. this morning. There were no reports of damage. Natasha Rupert, a seismologist with the UAF Geophysical Institute's Earthquake Information Center, says the magnitude 6.0 quake was centered in a rugged area about 62 miles northwest of Yakutat.
This earthquake was in a very remote mountainous region, glaciated region.
Rupert says that's a seismically active area with a complex intersection of tectonic structures. She says the Earthquake Information Center monitors hundreds of small quakes in the area every month.
Most of the earthquakes, of course, are very small and not felt by anybody. But once in a while, we have a significant earthquake that large enough to be felt by people in that area.
The Associated Press says Yakutat area residents reported feeling the trembler and that reports also were received as far east as Whitehorse, about 200 miles of the epicenter. In most places, summer isn't the best time to ski. But atop a mile-high glacier in Girdwood, elite skiers have converged from across the country and the world to train. APRN's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
It's a warm July day in Girdwood, but after a 10-minute helicopter ride to Eagle Glacier in the Chugach Mountains, it starts to look and feel a bit like winter. The temperature drops and snow blankets the ground. About 24 women, most from Alaska Pacific University's cross-country ski team, are at the glacier for a week-long training camp. Head coach Eric Flora gives pointers during the morning workout.
There we go. Use the body weight to tip into the hill. Very nice. Nice teamwork, ladies.
The athletes train 5 hours a day and spend their downtime in a rustic building precariously perched beside a 5,000-foot cliff. Olympian Keegan Randall has been coming to the trainings for 14 years and says they've helped her become one of the world's top speed skiers.
Well, I've always been really proud of Eagle Glacier and the opportunities we have here. And so when I'm out traveling around the World Cup, I like to talk it up. We can ski twice a day, and we can do so at a moderate altitude to where we don't really have to modify our training intensities. So it's pretty unique.
While snow is a constant on the glacier, relatively warm summer temperatures create less than ideal skiing conditions. As the athletes trudge up a steep hill on the 10-kilometer track, they struggle to push through the slushy snow. But Eric Flora says the tough environment has its perks.
Every time the Olympic comes up, the trail turns to a mess. You have rain, sleet, soft snow, and that's the magic of Eagle Glacier, because you can see in the course we have here, it's not easy now. It's really deep and like challenges the balance. And so we have a term for it, championship weather.
APU skiers aren't the only ones benefiting from the week-long training. Each year, at least one international athlete comes to Eagle Glacier. 2 years ago, Aino Kaisa Saarinen from Finland and APU skier and Olympian Holly Brooks bunked together. The two quickly became friends, and they reunited at the Sochi Olympics last winter, where Saarinen took home 2 silver medals.
We ran into Aino Kaisa, and she stopped us, and she started crying. And she said, "I want to thank you girls, because I think that spending time in Alaska and spending time with you really helped me and my team earn this medal." Of course, we wish that the U.S. had been able to bring home that medal, but that was really a priceless moment for us.
This summer, Norway's Celine Brun-Lie traveled 4,000 miles just to train on Eagle Glacier.
We don't have glaciers that we can ski on during the summer, so it's really nice to be able to ski this late in the summer.
Brun-Lie says she's having a blast in Alaska, and while the people she's training with will be fierce competitors on the World Cup circuit come winter, right now she's just trying to learn as much as she can.
I can teach Keegan something, she can teach me something, and then in the winter maybe I beat her because she told me that, or she beats me because I told her something. But I think that's the way it should work, and that's the fun thing about sports.
The women's training session ends Sunday, and APU's men's team will be on the glacier at the end of the month. On Eagle Glacier, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
Anchorage's People Mover bus system is trying to become more people and tech friendly. You can now use Google Maps to figure out your bus route. KSKA's Ann Hillman tried out the new tool this morning.
So I'm at the bus transit center, and I need to get back to the studio. So
I enter all of the data into the phone, and I do a search. All right, I can leave here theoretically in 2 minutes on the 45.
It took me about 15 seconds to plan my bus route. On other days, I've pored over paper schedules or stared at timetables on bus stop walls. With the new system, I used Google Maps on my smartphone, just like if I was looking for driving or biking directions. Mary Burt was waiting for the same bus.
I think it's a great idea. Just wish I had a smartphone, because I get on the bus and I'm hurrying up looking what's the best connection I can make to the next stop, where can I save time, is it going to coordinate, and to have it just download on instructions would be wonderful.
Public Transport Director Lance Wilbur says that was the idea, to make the bus system more accessible, especially for visitors.
It's really like Expedia for buses or Orbiz. You make travel arrangements. You find out where you want to come, where you want to go, and the time you want to do it, and it just brings it right up on the screen.
People Mover has been working on the project for 2 years. They had to convert their bus schedules and routes into a data format that Google could use with their mapping program. Soon, the department will make the information available to anyone who wants to use it to design different transport apps. Wilbur says they want to link the bus route planner with maps of the trail system, too. When it's time to board the bus, I glance at my phone, but I check my route the old-fashioned way, too.
Morning. Where will I get off to get to the university?
Settling in, I chat with other riders, like Roy McDowell, who has used the buses for years. His dad used to be a driver.
This is the route he drives. My dad was a singing bus driver back a few years back.
McDowell doesn't have a smartphone, but like many other frequent riders, he doesn't really need a trip planning map.
Most of the time, people know where they're going.
Turns out, thanks to McDowell, the driver, and the map tool, now I do too.
Stop requested.
In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Ella Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Joaquin Palomino reported from the Eagle Glacier. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Celebrate summer with Alaska Public Media and world-renowned barbecue chef and author Stephen Reichland of PBS and the Create Channel shows Barbecue University and Primal Grill on July 25th through the 27th. The benefit for Alaska Public Media include a barbecue salmon cook-off, barbecue class, and a pig roast over lunch. Tickets available at alaskapublic.org. It's sponsored by Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, the Hotel Captain Cook, and Crush Wine Bar and Bistro.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.